Blog Talk Radio.
Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. We stand on the shoreline. A vast sea of possibility spreads out endlessly before us. The waters are beautiful beyond description and powerful beyond imagination. The sea is in constant motion, ready to carry us to limitless fortune or sudden ruin. The sand is wet beneath our feet, and the waves lap at our shoes. The future calls to us, beckons us, and we must answer. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you tonight?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Oh, very good. It sounds like you're feeling very Sagan-esque tonight.
Yeah, well, you know, I wasn't intentionally channeling him, but it does sort of sound like some of the stuff from Cosmos there when you start laying it out that way, doesn't it? He talks about standing on the shore of a cosmic ocean, doesn't he?
With that's right. We've and taken the sky calls to us.
Yeah, exactly. Awesome. I see the future of virtually, practically limitless possibilities as a similar kind of image, a similar metaphor that so much lies before us, so much that we have a hard time getting our head around it, and sometimes it's cool to kind of just sit back and ponder how amazing the future might actually be, how much different the world might be in a relatively short period of time. And of course that's what we do every week, so we're gonna jump into that here in just a moment. Before we do, how are things going?
Man, everything's real good. Having what you would consider a normal week as the future rolls right on in. Every single week I make it an effort to try to keep up with news that is stuff that we would talk about on the show. I just find that it's, and this is something I've mentioned over and over, it's harder and harder all the time to keep up with it, and I find that exciting. So
we have got our work cut out for us. Well, I agree. I'm trying to keep up. I want to get at least one better all the time post up every day, and I've been falling down on that a little bit. The interesting thing is, it's not a challenge of finding something good to write about. It's like picking which one. It's like saying, well, which really amazing thing am I going to put up on this site today? Which was kind of fun because you get to choose one, but it's also kind of hard because it's like, well, maybe I should do four or five of these, and often time doesn't permit. But we've been having an odd week. I don't know if it's made the national news or not, but we've got like massive wildfires going on outside of Denver. We had. This major windstorm kick up on Sunday, and I looked out Sunday evening and the sky was just brown, and I said, wait, that's not dust. And sure enough, I turned on the TV and a big fire had started, and I think they've got it under control now, but just very odd thing to have happen this time of year. Normally we expect, if they're going to happen at all, and we don't want them to happen, but if we're going to have big wildfires, that's a summer thing, July, August, that sort of thing. And here it is happening in March of all times. Just a kind of a dry winter combined with some really heavy winds to spread it, and just an odd thing to have happen, I guess.
Yeah, I hope that doesn't mean that y'all are in for a particularly tough summer if it's getting like an early start on that kind of thing. Once ground has burned, it won't burn again this year.
That particular ground won't burn again.
That particular ground, but there's lots more ground that could potentially burn. So I wish you guys the best out there.
Yeah, well, thank you. I think April will come along and we'll get our usual pounding of snow in April, and it should moisten things up, and hopefully things will, yeah, we'll get start getting the snow melt from the mountains, and you know, we won't be this tinderbox.
We'll get
that. Everything will improve. Well, let's jump into our program. We've got so much to talk about, and I thought, since we're talking about the shores of possibility, what better way to introduce this topic than an email that we got from PJ Manny earlier today. Our good friend PJ, who's often a guest on this program, even when she's not here, provides material for the show. And you know what? I've just lost my server connection, so I was going to open this and read it. And you know what? I'm not able to do that, Stephen. If you've got internet, are you able to do that?
Yes, I am, and it might take me just a second to get to it. Here it is. What her father – I'll tell you a little bit about PJ's family. Her father is an interesting man in his own right, as interesting as his daughter. That is saying something, because PJ is one of the most interesting people I've had the pleasure of getting to know.
Same here.
He was obsessed with exploration and continues to be. I would say, Phil, that he's one of those neat guys that actually he didn't just follow other people's exploits. He actually went to the poles.
Right.
And one of the things he was able to obtain is various memorabilia from polar explorations. And probably the crown jewel, not probably, the crown jewel of his collection that he was able to get was the letter written by Scott. Help me with the full name. It's R. Scott. It was who passed away after having made it to the pole. He and his expedition on the way back did not make it. And so he wrote
exactly, and it shows you how useless I am without Google that I'm not able to answer your question. Yeah, that's R. Scott. That's right. That's the guy's name. Yeah.
And at any rate, he had actually made it second to the pole. It was a race to the pole, and what he was attempting to do was to do kind of a sort of the slow way of getting there. He had all these different things, laid out, different places to stop and get provisions and everything. He was doing the slow route to the pole and was overtaken by weather trying to do it the slow way, whereas the person who made it to the pole first dashed to the pole, dashed back. You know, I mean, that's
right. Anyway, that approach proved more survivable than the other. His name was Sir Robert Falcon Scott, which is my way of telling you that I've come back online. And I think it's interesting enough. Let's go ahead. I'm going to read PJ's message because I think this is very cool.
It's beautiful.
She says,
PJ said, yeah.
Yeah, she says, I was raised by a father obsessed with exploration of land, sea, and space, but especially the Earth's poles. In the 19th and early 20th centuries, the poles were to explorers what Mars is to us, not quite accessible. A place we could almost inhabit, like a dream. Eventually, mankind got there, but there was a price for discovery. There always is. My father has traveled to both poles himself, and for fun, he helped produce a NOVA episode on the South Pole back in the 80s with two other polar fanatic friends. He sold or donated most of his polar exploration collection years ago, but he's finally selling the crown jewel of his collection on Friday in honor of the Scott and Amundsen centenary. It is Sir Robert Falcon Scott's first farewell letter to the treasurer of the expedition. He wrote it in his diary as he huddled in his sleeping bag when he realized he and his comrades would die on the ice. He asked for help for the families left behind and understanding. When you read the letter, think of the explorers to come. And I think if it won't take too long, let's go ahead and let's have the letter too, don't you think?
Absolutely.
Here it is.
I have it here. Do you want to take it, Phil, or should I?
Go for it, man, if you want to.
Okay. Let's see here. I was actually reading it from the letter itself, which is probably not a good idea because the handwriting is a little shaky, as you can imagine, under those circumstances.
Yeah, I recommend reading the
I'm going to read the text.
Text on the webpage there, yeah.
Yeah. We have been to the pole, and we shall die like gentlemen. I hope that this may reach you. I fear that we must go and that it leaves the expedition in a bad muddle. But we have been to the pole and we shall die like gentlemen. I regret only for the women we leave behind. If this diary is found, it will show how we stuck by dying companions and fought this thing out well to the end. I think it will show that the spirit of pluck and power to endure has not passed out of the race. If recognition of this fact can be given by people, will you please do your best to have our people looked after, those dependent upon us? I have my wife and child to think of. I'm sure you will do your best to see this provision is made. And it goes on from there. I feel, is that, would you like
just
to take it further?
Can't help but get a chill, can you? I mean, it's just so moving. These guys, they know they're doomed, and they're dealing with it with such courage and such class. You know, this is the you think of something like this happening today, and I don't know how people would respond. I don't know what they would do, but I would like to think if I were in that situation, that this is how I would handle it, right? When I read this, I think these guys were heroes. You know, they were heroes to go to the pole, and they were heroes to comport themselves in this way. Once they realized that they had come to the end, and I think this is some might say depressing way of entering into our discussion of standing on the shores of possibility, but just as I mentioned in the introduction, that the sea can lead us to great fortune or it can lead us to ruin, the risk that's involved is always a piece of the equation, and we do stand on the edge of major steps forward, similar to the step that Robert Falcon was taking there. We talk a lot about the Apollo program on this show, and that was a very similar thing. And in fact, I don't know if Stephen, have you ever read it? Have we ever talked about the prepared speech that President Nixon had ready to give?
Yes, I read it in the book. Rocketman. It was in the, and we've never mentioned it on the show, but yes, Nixon had a speech prepared if Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong had not been able to lift off the moon. And there was, apparently, he had been alerted by NASA that was a real possibility. We get there, we're on the moon, we explore the moon, and we're ready to go, and for whatever reason, we can't lift off, and it's a problem that can't be fixed.
I mean, well, it's the darndest thing about rockets. Sometimes you push the button and they don't fire. So, and the one on the LEM had been through more things than any rocket ever built before had ever been through. So theoretically it was going to take off, but maybe it wouldn't. And there was a speech very, very moving, very much in this vein, talking about the fact that those guys have reached the limit of where they're going, and they're not going any further. And it's a very poignant thing to grapple with, but if we are going to move on from having explored the moon to maybe going back to settle the moon, to explore Mars, to explore the outer planets, this possibility is always going to be with us. The idea that people might get out beyond where any help for them is possible, and we can only hope that the spirit of exploration and the need, I really think it is a need, the need for humanity to move to the next step will always find itself expressed in such eloquent terms. That's our hope for whatever we do moving into the future. But now let's talk a little bit. Did you have something else you want to say about this?
Yeah, it was on the same subject. It was a movie that came back a while back called We Were Soldiers. It had
Mel Gibson.
Do you remember
yeah.
that movie? It's a great,
yeah,
great
I love
movie.
That movie. Yeah,
it's a great movie, and it got some flack from some critics. You know, it had some dying soldier scenes in it, and one of them was, I mean, you know, the soldier was saying in his basically his final words was, tell my wife I love her and that I was thinking of her, and then he dies. And the critics are going,
right.
Oh, he's rolling his eyes. Oh, that's just, you know, that's just stupid. And, you know, and basically writes a review to that effect. Okay. You know, how cliche is this? Well, you know, come to find out, this is based on, this is, you know, that We Were Soldiers movie was a true story, and that was
a
real
story,
soldier,
yeah,
who died, and that's really what he said, you know, when he,
right,
died. It turns,
right,
out that is what we think about as that last moment approaches, is our loved ones and everything. And so it's not corny. It's what we tend to do. And so, yeah, I think that spirit is in us, Phil, and we'll be able to, as a people, the human race, will dig down deep and find that as we're exploring space. So
or whatever the new frontiers are, because
I think we've got some
interesting examples here, and I thought it was appropriate to start as we venture off the shore of possibility and into the sea of possibility. I thought it was appropriate that we start with the one that you and I were talking about just before the show started. This is really opening up a new world, and it may be a new world that we've already opened up for ourselves. Tell us about that.
Well, George Dyson, who is the famous son of a famous man, Freeman Dyson,
brother of Esther Dyson.
There you go.
Okay.
A very accomplished family, a family of very smart people who have done great things for a long time.
Yes.
But anyway, he has written this book. It's just been published recently, called Turing's Cathedral. And it's interesting that I find the title just a slightly misleading, because it doesn't have a lot to do with Turing. Alan Turing. It has a lot more to do with von Neumann.
Okay.
And he explains why the title. Turing, it was his idea. You know, here's the universal machine. Here's how to, you know, here's what we would expect a universal machine to, how we expect it to operate. And, you know, he kind of lays out the architecture. And then it was up to others, including von Neumann, to set out to make it. And they did, and it's just a very neat book, and he lays out the idea in the book that what they invented back then was not just a machine, but in effect they were inventing a new universe, the digital universe, which it's looking more and more like a real universe all the time, isn't it, Phil?
Well, it really does. I mean, we think of it becomes a universe when our consciousness actually resides in there, you know, when we can be uploaded,
yeah,
into it, and that it's something short of that then. But every day, you know, and you can mark it every year. You can mark it probably every month if you actually pay attention. But truly, every day we get a little bit deeper into that world, or that world,
right,
gets a little bit deeper into us, however you want to look at it. But the reality of that place, if we can call it a place, becomes stronger, and our presence there becomes more nearly permanent. We are spending time there right now, aren't we? I mean,
yeah, exactly. You and I are in a way in that universe exactly right now. But
as are our friends in the chat room right now. Yeah.
Exactly. We're in a space that we share that's virtual. You know, it's not, you know, we're not next to each other, but we might as well be because of what we're able to share.
I'm going to go one better even, because the folks in the chat room right now are talking about George Norrie, like hollow earth stuff, okay? So they're in like this really weird world right now. they're like, you know, they're off on planet X right now, okay, which is awesome. That's what we're all about here, is enabling that kind of
exactly.
And
hang on, guys. We're going to work Hollow Earth and a lot of other things into this conversation in just a second. But
absolutely.
Yeah. I thought this was interesting. In 1953, this is when these guys were working on this stuff, okay? There were 53 kilobytes of high-speed RAM on planet Earth, okay?
And wow, 53K. You didn't even have enough to make one 64K computer, right?
Exactly.
You couldn't even make one original Mac out of that.
And here's what he did. He added it up. You know, we got 5K over here in California, in New Jersey, where von Neumann was working. We had another 10K. You know, I mean, he went, literally, you know.
Wow.
And, you know, based on declassified documents, we know the Soviets had 2K. You know, he added it all up. It was 53 kilobytes in 1953. Easy to keep up with, right? 53. And so if we'd have added a kilobyte every year, you know, we didn't do that, though. We added a lot more. We added RAM on Earth. It's increased exponentially to the point that, Phil, if you have your iPhone in your pocket, then you have 10,000 times the RAM in your pocket than was on the planet Earth.
And existed on the entire planet at that time.
In 1953. Wow. And so, so imagine how intimately associated we are now with it. You know, it's not just a few just brilliant geniuses working with tiny amounts of RAM, you know, in far-flung places. It's everybody, and they have it in their pocket. You know, I mean, it's important to our lives. We interact with this stuff all the time. So, and he's saying this is a universe that's like the Big Bang. I mean, just boom, it's just taking off. And, you know, one of my thoughts about this is, you know, imagine how important fictional universes are going to become, Bill. I mean, if we have this universe, you know, that's exploding in possibilities in every direction, right? Then all of a sudden things like, our fictional universes that we have visited in literature and, you know, in movies and things like that, you know, these become places that we get to visit. And, you know, we already do it to some extent in video games, but it will be much more real to us. It'll be a virtual reality that will be unlike anything we've experienced before. So, you know, whether you're
to be able to actually experience one of these fictional worlds the way we experience
this
day to day life. That's the thing that we will. That will ultimately do. I mean, that people will do, and I think you make a really good point that that games are already pushing in that direction. Any
right.
movie that comes out, just about any, like, well, not any movie. If it's, you know, Iron Lady, right?
Yeah.
You know, the story of Margaret Thatcher probably doesn't have a video game.
Yeah,
it doesn't have a video game associated with it. But but any big action special effects movie has a game associated with it, right? And anything that has has a plot that involves a kind of a you know relentless motion forward of action ends up getting a game. And there are fictional universes that have become game universes even before the current world of video games that we have, you know, back in when it was just text chat based games or just very, very crude graphics games. They were already making Star Trek games back in those days. I used to play in a massively, what they call those, massively multiplayer online role play game, MORPG, MMORPG, based on the Narnia books by C.S. Lewis. And it was like, you know, you'd go into that whole world. It was just text, but you were there. You know what I mean? It was like, it's like you were experiencing it. Well, what you're talking about is people will go into Narnia and there will be the centaurs. There will be the, you know, the talking animals and the giants and all the rest of it. And you'll be experiencing them the way you experience people in your life day to day, the way you experience the guy you bump into walking into the drugstore or something like that. And that's a pretty amazing thought. And you know what, Stephen, I'll go down even one better, because ultimately the fictional universes where many of us spend a lot of our time are kind of the ones we've made up ourselves, right? There's a great episode in Star Trek The Next Generation, introduced a character who became kind of a recurring character, and I think he showed up in one of the movies, a guy named Barclay,
right,
who would go into the holodeck, and he had rewritten his world so that things worked the way they should. He was this very shy, very socially awkward, you know, very nerdy kind of a guy, and he was a complete unknown. We had never heard of him before this episode because he didn't even register in this world. But in his version of the Starship Enterprise, which we got to visit with him on the holodeck, he is like the center of it. Right, all the major characters, they all respect him, they all look up to him. Deanna Troi, the you know, the counselor, she was in love with him. It was a fictional version of the world he actually lived in. I think that people are going to spend a lot of time in worlds like those. In fact, one of the risks that always gets pointed out around that kind of technology, Scott Adams in The Dilbert Future called it the holodeck fallacy, where he said that basically all human progress will stop as soon as we get a holodeck, because that's all anybody's ever going to want to do, right? They'll go into a holodeck, and basically, well, in his version, everybody's going to go into a holodeck and, you know, have sex with the supermodel of their choice. But it's the same idea. Basically, you're going to take the world you live in and rewrite it so that things are working exactly the way you want. And then why would you ever leave that world? What do you think, Stephen? Is that a great danger for the kind of technology you're talking about?
Yeah, I think so. If we find these worlds more compelling than the real world, then, you know, we spend more and more time there. I think there's some chance that, you know, there'll be some people that just, you know, check out. You know, you don't hardly ever see them. I think that's a risk. I think that's a real risk. But, I think also real, productive things will be done within these fictional worlds, too. I think real work that is productive and useful and real interaction with other people, you know, they may look like a centaur, but it's really a real person behind it. There'll be a lot of productive things that'll be done through virtual reality as well. And I think also we'll kind of tend to carry our virtual realities with us into the real world and have sort of an augmented reality version of, you know, where the centaur friend that we made, while visiting Narnia, you know, accompanies us in the real world. You know, it's sort of the thing we've laughed about before, Phil. With the advent of cell phones, particularly with the ones with the little earpieces that you put in your ear, someone having a completely animated disembodied conversation, you don't assume they're crazy anymore. You know, I mean,
we're pretty much okay with people walking around talking out loud to no one. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we've gotten okay with that because, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, stay away from that guy. That guy's nutty. Well, you know,
that guy is dangerous. Yeah.
I say that in another 5 or 10 years, you know, the guy that's talking to his friend, the unicorn, that you cannot see next to him, is going to be equally assumed to be sane until we have better information to the contrary. You know, it's
right.
So I think there'll be a lot of people that tend to overdo it and will probably end up having problems that, you know, hopefully people that know and love them will have interventions. You're spending, you know, all your time in Narnia. You never are with us. And that kind of, I can see things like that happening, but I think that also it'll be an opportunity to open up doors to creativity that we don't have now,
I think there's all kinds of really interesting possibilities there that, you know, yeah. For one thing, there's some people that just don't get along with anybody very well, and this will be great for them, right? You know, because it's like they don't have to try anymore. You know, I mean, whether that's sad or that's a good thing. It's certainly good in the sense that they'll be happy, and the rest of the world will be happy too, because they won't be dealing with it. But I also think that there's the possibility for people who had a really hard time interacting with others in this space will find good ways to interact with each other in that space. I think there's a lot of kind of serendipitous stuff that will happen. But something Sally just wrote, and before I come to this, because I don't want to lose the thought. I've been sidebarring this for a couple of minutes. I realized as I was reading through the chat that the reason they were talking about George Norrie, in addition to the fact that our chat room guys are all obsessed with the Hollow Earth theory, is that Ben Goertzel is going to be on tonight. So we should make note. Our good friend Ben Goertzel is going to be on Coast to Coast AM, so everybody should stay up and listen to that. Or I guess if you're like a paying subscriber to the site, you can listen to the archive shows, right?
I think so, yeah. Ben is always interesting. Ben Goertzel, there was a bit of a danger that he was going to steal Ray Kurzweil's movie. And it was he's just that big of a character.
I believe that danger was realized, actually. I think Ben was kind of the secret, kind of the stealth star of Transcendent Man, right?
Yeah,
he's kind of the guy you remember. I mean, you remember Ray, of course, but you really sort of remember Ben, and he's a great friend of this program. We've had him on numerous times, so he's gonna slum there on Coast AM. That's fine if he wants to go be on some rinky-dink little show that gets 5 million listeners a night. That's that's his business. But he'll come back to us eventually. Anyway, I just wanted to mention that because in case anyone's listening to this live isn't reading the chat, that's pretty cool that Ben's going to be on there and give it a listen. What I was going to say was, Sally writes something that brings something to mind for me here. She says, my idea of virtual Mars with the kind of detail that exists in reality would be one of these kinds of worlds. Now, here is where I think we can tie this back to the letter that PJ shared for us. One problem with these fictional worlds is that there will never be the things at stake in them that we have in this world, right? I mean, unless they're set up really differently than we imagine them being set up. If you go, live on virtual Mars, you're not really going to run out of food, and you're not really, you're not going to freeze to death. None of the things that will happen, that potentially could happen to you on real Mars, are going to happen to you there. And of course, virtual Mars can be a lot of fun. It can be like Barsoom. You can have Tharks. You can set it up any way you want. You can have canals. However you want to do it. It can be real, this really much more interesting place than real Mars in a lot of ways. But one element that would be different is what's at stake. Your actual life would never really be at stake in virtual Mars the way it would be in real Mars, and that's why I think it's really interesting. We've got this one of our topics here, kind of flipping it over from the shores of possibility in the virtual world to the shores of possibility in the real world. The piece I wrote, I think it was earlier this week, might have been last week. Who's Up for Mars? This business of Elon Musk saying that within 30 to 50 years he's going to have it such that you can take a round trip to Mars for $500,000. Now, I had to take some issue with the folks at IO9 who said, well, $500,000 is hardly going to put it within the spending power of the average person. For one thing, $500,000 won't even get you into low Earth orbit today. Is that right? I think that's true.
Yeah, it's presently, but we hope that will change.
Well, yeah. I'm sure it will. I'm sure it will. But right now, even if you want to be one of these like super space tourists who goes to, the space station or something like that, you're laying out seven figures for that. I'm pretty sure, right? You don't do those things for less than that kind of money.
If you were to go to Mars using the NASA model, it'd be a multi-trillion-dollar project.
Exactly. There's no consumer model for getting to Mars, not even for rich people to get to Mars using the current model. So when Elon Musk talks about doing it for $500,000, he's talking about a huge economy of scale coming into play. He's talking about cutting the price of going to Mars unbelievably. I mean, just enormously. But what I think the guys at IO9 didn't miss is he's talking 30 to 50 years from now. And if we're saying 30 years from now, $500,000 sadly, it's not going to be that much money. If they're talking $2,012, I'm not saying we're all going to have that much in change in our couch cushions, right? But if you trace what was considered a normal family wage 30 years ago to where it is today, and if you do that again, you're still a little shy, probably of $500,000, but not that shy. You know what I mean? It's not that different. That would still be a lot to pay, as I pointed out in my blog post. It would still be expensive to spend your entire income on a trip to Mars. But the point is, what's the average income today? Probably about $50,000, something like that.
Yeah. So 10 years
today,
worth of
that income will not get you anywhere near Earth orbit, right? And Elon Musk is saying that in 30 years it'll get you to Mars and back.
Yeah. You know, you had mentioned something. Phil, I'm completely changing the subject, doing like just no segue at all, just an abrupt change. Is that cool?
Well, before you do, wait, there's one thing I wanted to do with this. If we could, we stay on Mars
bring,
just for
bring
a
it, bring it home. I'm sorry. I was on a different thing. So go ahead.
Okay, that's all right. We'll go to your thing next. Here's my question. If the choice comes down to this, Stephen, you can live your perfect ideal fictional life in the virtual world, or you've got the 500K and you can take the round trip to Mars, a la Elon Musk. Which do you do?
Well, here's the good news, Phil, is you don't have to choose between the two. What you do, Phil, is, and this is, I think, would be absolutely essential for long space flights, is that you book your trip to Mars, and you know that it takes, you know, what, like nine months,
anyway,
I think.
Yeah,
months to get there. So what do? Well, you sit on a beach sipping pina coladas, enjoying the most beautiful virtual reality that can be imagined for the months that it takes to get to Mars. And you know, that's how you spend your time rather than being completely bored out of your mind in a tin can. You know, I think that's how you get there without losing your brain, is that you have virtual reality at your disposal. So you get to enjoy this idealistic virtual life, but you also get to do these neat things here in the real world. Because you were, you know, and to a large extent because of the virtual reality. Virtual reality enables you to do that. Otherwise, you'd go crazy.
Well, it would be a real challenge, that's for sure. But what you are taking on, you understand what you are assuming now, is the risk of the real world, right?
Right.
Because you can enjoy your beach life back on Earth, and you're not going to potentially die. And in fact, you can enjoy your beach life and even take a virtual trip to Mars, which Sally is voting in favor of, I see in the chat room, and have subjectively almost exactly the same experience, or maybe the same experience, but never subject yourself to the risk. But you're saying you, Stephen, would prefer to combine them in such a way that you're going to enjoy your virtual life in the context of actually accepting the risk and making a real trip to a real place.
That's right, and doing things in this reality as well, and getting to enjoy the pina colada on the beach. You know.
Yeah, they're both good ideas, and I agree with you. That's how I slice it too. I would not want to commit 100% to the virtual world, precisely because of the what's really at risk there. I don't know that I'd get bored with the virtual existence the way, you know, people say. Well, it's like there's no challenge. You know how everything's going to come out, and it's not going to be interesting. You know, if everything's going your way, I can endure that for quite a while, I must say. You know, that's not a thing I'm going to have a problem with until I can't imagine how long that has to go on before I say, no, I just can't take this anymore. Something's got to, like, you know, really suck here pretty soon. But the idea that I'm kind of vested in this universe, and I like the idea of us as a species moving out into the universe and exploring space and doing those things really for real here, I think is too compelling to let go of, and I would definitely want to do that as well. Okay, so I know you've got an intriguing next step to take us on, so go ahead.
Okay, this is Fast Forward Radio is going coast to coast for just a moment. Okay, let's just. You know,
you mean George Norrie style, coast to coast?
Yeah, we're going to do a little George Norrie style stuff.
Okay.
Let's think about this. What would make a virtual reality as compelling as possible? I think, and I submit to you, Phil, that one way that we could make virtual realities as compelling as we possibly could is to relieve ourselves of the memory of the real reality while we're in virtual reality. Okay. In other words, make that the only real world that we're aware of while we're in that virtual reality.
But before you said that, you know what my immediate answer to that was?
What's that?
Agent Smith in The Matrix. It's the smell, right?
It's the smell. I can't
stand
it. You've
got to get the smell right. You know, we're wrong.
That's the thing that really drives
reality home, okay?
It's
the smell. But putting smell aside, I'm sorry. You were
okay.
Saying,
Well, yeah, I mean, you would want a virtual reality that includes smells and everything. So, in other words, you're not just wearing goggles to get into these virtual realities. This is something you you jack into with, like, you know, Neo style.
And you're getting the full physical experience, including
including
olfactory.
And, so you don't. And,
but
you
were
talking
about something else. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. And so here's the deal. You don't have a memory of the other reality while you're within this reality. So here's the thing. Dr. James Gates is a physicist. He's working on string theory. And there's this really interesting YouTube video I caught this week. He's talking about within the computations or within the formula that are coming up with within string theory, he is finding error correction code. Now, I mean, it sounds like almost an Easter egg in the universe. He makes this argument. It's pretty interesting, and I'm going to put the link in the chat room. And so, you know, what does that mean to you, Phil? I mean, if you know, and I think it's come up before that, you know, what's the chances of us actually being in the real reality rather than in simulation, if there are trillions of simulations out in the future, if our descendants want to simulate this time, and they do it a million times versus the one time that it really happened, what's
right.
the chances of us being in the real version of it?
It's a million to one. Well, shoot, if they do it three times, it's 3-1, right?
Exactly.
You know, if it ever happens, right, chances are that's where we are. If it has ever happened, you know, it's a coin toss right there. If it's happened one time, it's a coin toss. So,
yeah.
If they've done it trillions of times, forget it, man. We're living in a simulation. But if they've even done it two or three times, it's like chances are that's where we are. It's a staggering thought. Now, my real answer to this, I was watching that video just the other day, and it just it blows my mind to hear him talking about this. The stock answer has got to be, it's not really error correction code. It just looks a lot like it, and he has mistaken it for error correction code, even though he and all his colleagues are looking at it going, man, that's what that is, right? That is exactly what it is. But so the first answer is, it's not really. And we're just reading a model of the universe into data that we're gathering about the universe. Although I don't get the impression that he was some kind of big Nick Bostrom fan. Who decided he was going to prove that the universe is a simulation? But if you're going to contend with that, if you're going to say, okay, that's really what that is, then we have to accept the likelihood, right? The probability that the world we're living in is not the original universe. That what we're experiencing is in fact a simulation. Created by beings that we would think of from where we sit as our descendants. But going back to the memory thing, Stephen, who you're saying might actually be us, and that we wiped our memories clean so that we could have some virtual experiences where it seemed like something was at stake, or where were you going with this?
Exactly. It gives you skin in the game. If you really believe that this is this is real and not some sort of simulation, then you would tend to take it more seriously, and would play the game for real. And so that's, I think it's a fascinating thought.
Yeah, well, the idea that we might be characters that future people who actually are the real us have opted to play in order to, on the one hand, it makes me annoyed with my other self, you know, my future superior self, because I don't like being jerked around, but but at the same time, I can't be annoyed with him because that's me, right? I ultimately, if it turned out that was really the world we're living in, it would sum up to a choice I made. I would be sitting here arguing with myself. Finally, that you know, it's like if you don't like jerking yourself, if you don't like being jerked around, don't jerk yourself around would be the only answer that anyone would be able to give to me. So it's a compelling idea. I don't know that will we ever get an answer to that. How long will it be before we get an answer to that?
I don't know. I have no but I find it interesting that, you know, I would think that basically at the point of singularity, then at that point you would get your answer. I'm not sure exactly why I think that, but it just seems like that would be a logical point at which to find out. So,
well, if there are Easter eggs built in to the universe, one thing I would build into a simulation universe would be, once people got to the point where they could create a sufficiently compelling simulation, I would have the universe issue some kind of error message saying, hey, by the way, you're already in one, right? That would only be nice, you know. But then again, maybe the plan is to always just, you know, keep, you know, boxes within turtles all the way down. Maybe simulations just keep nesting within further simulations, and you get just more and more cool stuff. And who knows how many generations back up through we would have to go to get to the real Stephen Gordon, right? The mad genius who actually programmed this entire universe, right? That's
Well, I would say more than one generation. I feel very much removed from that Stephen Gordon.
I tell you, Stephen, that's the future we're hurtling towards, right there. That's the amazing thing. Well, I'll tell you, now that we've covered all this cosmic stuff, it's kind of hard to go to some of these other topics. But let me just
let's do it. Let's touch on the news we're getting about Watson these days. That is extremely interesting. Watson, of course, is the AI that beat the champions at Jeopardy. And
right.
To me, I thought that was a huge, huge point. You know, as soon as it happened, everybody's trying to, you know, it was like the pros are trying to downplay it. Well, it was just, you know, it was just this or it was just that. To me, I mean, it's a general knowledge program, and the computer won.
Right.
Okay, that's
right.
A pretty big deal to me. So now IBM is sending Watson to med school. You know, it was something I said right as it was, you know, I don't want to give myself credit for this, but I was, you and I were talking about the Jeopardy thing that they, you know, the week it happened, Phil, and
yep.
I said, you know, Got to send him to med school now. Well, they, you know, they probably were already thinking about that. They sent him to med school, and they're saying now that Watson is coming along very well. Is in essence a second year med student, and they're working on one of the things that they're working on is giving Watson eyes to be able to see, and be able, you know, to understand what Watson is looking at when it looks at an MRI. An X-ray film, things like that. Right now, it's just, you know, you feed into Watson. Here's a patient with this problem, and this problem. What do you think? And Watson returns its best answer. That's what's happening now. But they want to get it also to where it can read X-rays, and they're working on that. And you know, and also at the same time, Watson is being adapted to bank customer servicing. So, you know, Watson gets to do lots of things because Watson's a computer that can be, you know, duplicated and can be used in multiple different ways at the same time. But I just find it fascinating how well it's doing, the fact that they're working on getting it to be able to read X-rays, EKGs, MRIs, and that sort of thing. And the thought is that, you know, we will have – every doctor then will have a, you know, in their pocket, a Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center educated doctor. You know, Dr.
Right.
Watson will be there at their, and you know, that's the ultimate cancer med school. Okay, that's where you go if you want to be the cancer expert for your region. Well, Watson is going to that school, and Watson will be available to every doctor everywhere. And here's the thing. I think it won't be long. He'll be available to all of us, whether we're a doctor or not. And
that's what I was going to say. It's not just the doctors. It's the patients who are eventually going to have him. And the thing is, if you say, well, which people will? Well, he's really only good for this much medical practice, right? He's only good for like 80% of what people need. And actually, he's only just about a better than average doctor. Okay, fine. Imagine if everybody in the world. had a better than average doctor at their personal disposal. I mean, you know, this goes back to our abundance discussion.
All the time. He's with you all the time.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
that's all you are his whole practice, right? I mean, just
you are his one patient.
Yeah.
Let me give you just kind of, an analogy. You know, I have a camera on me all the time now because
right.
I have my iPhone on me all the time. I always have my camera with me. And so it's amazing the things that I do with cameras now that I would never have thought of using a camera for 15 years ago. Yeah, we had cameras. We had digital cameras back then. But, I mean, they were you didn't carry them everywhere. Well, now I'm clicking photos all day long. You know, there's always something that I need to remember or to, you know, and I'll take a picture of a list that I've written out, or it might be a letter, you know, that I need to look over at lunchtime. I don't want to take the whole file with me, you know, things like that. Well, that's
right.
The fact that I've got a camera with me all the time, that's just because it's built in my phone. I'll have a doctor with me at all times soon, and he will be, and it'll be a much different experience than the doctor care that we get now. Right now, we get sick care. We when we're sick, we go to the trouble of getting an appointment and going in and talking to the doctor. We're about to enter a time when we have the doctor with us all the time, and he keeps us from getting sick to begin with. We are always well because we have a doctor with us at all times telling us how to optimize our health. And
well, and in fact, to just kind of draw all these threads together, going back to one of the things you and I talked about as a possible topic for the program tonight, this news that's been bouncing around about a test now that can be done that will accurately predict whether you're going to have a heart attack in 2 weeks, right? It gives you like a 2 week warning as to whether you're going to have a heart attack. Everybody reads this and it's like, that's so amazing. I mean, I read that and it's like, this is like Minority Report applied to medicine, right? It's
right.
Like the Department of pre-trauma, pre-medical trauma
yeah.
here. It's like they can
you
they
can calmly
they can catch
walk
it
into
before
your,
it happens.
You can calmly walk into the ER and say, you know, I've just been informed that I'm going to have a heart attack in 2 weeks. Let's keep this from happening.
Right.
And so my thought is, well, how do you do that? You know, we don't have blood tests every week or however often. Well, you know, there are some people that prick their fingers every day. They have to for medical reasons, but the most of us don't. So what? How do we work it to where we we have these tests done all the time. We have it on an ongoing basis. So I was just thinking about it. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just gonna say it's. I think you've already answered the question, right? You before you were gonna carry your. You carry your camera with you all the time. Now you're carrying your iPhone 9 with the Dr. Watson app and, say, with the XPRIZE medical tricorder app, both running on them. And, I don't know if even a pinprick on the finger is going to be required. Maybe Watson will just want to do a swab inside your cheek or test your urine or something like that periodically every day, every other day or something like that. But there will be some much less intrusive than we think of now way for equipment that we're going to have on our persons in a very short time to be tracking that stuff. I think it'll be a very straightforward thing.
Yeah, and it could be something like just a patch, it looks like a nicotine patch, but it really has a
oh, there you go.
Blood and
it's an interface to your iPhone.
Yeah,
or
exactly.
Droid. It might be a Droid, whatever, it's all good.
Exactly. Whatever your preference is, but the point is we know in advance what's going on with our bodies and we can address problems before they really become problems. And That's pretty cool. I'm very much looking forward to that day.
I am too. Really exciting stuff. Well, listen, we didn't get to delve too far. I think we waded about ankle deep into the ocean of possibility, but fortunately, we'll be able to continue this discussion every week for the foreseeable future. So I'm not going anywhere. We'll keep talking about this. But before we go, I think it's just about time to cue up the music. Before we go, I just want to remind everyone that this weekend is Christine Peterson's Personal Life Extension Conference. If you're in the Bay Area, or if you can get to the Bay Area, whether you've signed up for it ahead of time or not, there's still room. They're still looking for people to attend. See if you can't make it. We're also going to provide links on the Speculist, and I'll put this up on Better All the Time as well. There is a live webcast feed of the entire event for those who aren't in the Bay Area or aren't able to make it to the Bay Area. So I'm hoping all of us can get as much of that conference in this weekend as possible. Great opportunity to hear some really tuned in, really smart people talking about practical things we can do to extend our lives. So that's something you don't want to miss.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right, well, Steve, music, what have we got going on music-wise this evening?
Music-wise, we've got Date with Destiny by Max Carmichael. I hope you enjoyed it. It kind of reminded me of The Clash, early 80s Clash. So see what you think.
Okay, a little Clash-esque Max Carmichael singing, what was the song again?
Date with Destiny.
Date with Destiny. How fast-forward radio appropriate. All right, well, thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Always a pleasure talking with you. Thanks to all our friends in the chat room, everyone listening live, everyone listening via MP3. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We will be back again next week with an all-new show. And until next time, live to see it.
Armies of the night obscure the stars. Don't despair till somebody cares. You've got to carry on. And though they say you're just a paranoid in paradise, you're just afraid to get bit by that discord price. They've got your number, you better change it to keep those rude boys away. You're an outcast child, you know, but it got you fun. They say